Anyway, this time of year, brethren, we do something physical that focuses our attention on something spiritual, something that we should be doing all year long. We examine our lives, we purge sin from our lives, and for these 7-8 days here, we focus on not letting any of that sin back in our life. But I want to ask a very fundamental question today. How do you know what to focus on? How do you know what is considered leavening in your life? Who makes that assessment? To put it in biblical terms, who judges you? Who determines what is and is not right in your life? Today, I want to explore the idea of God's judgment in our life. Brethren, we all need a judge. We all are judged by somebody, and we all need an accurate assessment of ourselves. So why? Let's start with the first question, I guess. Why do we even need a judge? I think the first cause is we cannot determine the cause from the cause of our results. We simply cannot. Now, we're pretty good at it in the human terms. We're pretty good at it in the physical. Anything we can observe, anything we can measure, anything that we can watch and scientifically measure, we can determine outcomes. That's how we get by in life. That's how we get many things to work and function for us. Even with that, though, there is a rule. The farther away you are from the cause to the results or the effects, the less likely you are as human to draw the dots between the two or to draw the connection. And there's another rule. We are pretty good about looking back and determining the cause of our results. We need to look no further than the recent financial meltdown. Once it occurred, we had everybody all over the place pontificating on how we got there, and we were able to make some pretty accurate assessments of what caused that to happen. There are many other things in our life, but the reality is, the farther away we are from the cause of something to the results, the less likely we are to determine the actual cause. It's one of the reasons, in fact, history often repeats itself, because we forget. And we don't learn the lessons of history, and we go and do the same thing. Brethren, again, physically, we're fairly good at it. We can draw connections between health and how we eat dietarily. Again, often it's too late. We look back on it, but still we can draw those connections. But when it comes to the moral and the spiritual aspects of our life, we cannot determine it. It is literally impossible for us to know what is right and what is wrong. If God had not told us, brethren, we simply would not know. Simply would not. We do not have the ability within us to draw connections, spiritually speaking, between the cause and the effect. Because, for the same reasons, they cannot be easily measured. You cannot scientifically measure these. And often, when it comes to spiritual aspects especially, the results are significantly delayed. They might last a lifetime and be dozens and dozens of years later before you feel the effects of breaking God's law. I think we can illustrate this through an example. Pornography. It's rampant in our society. How many people that get involved in pornography as a young teenager, or young adult, or even young person, any age. How many people that get involved in that draw the connection of marital problems 30 years later in their life? Nobody does that of their own. It has to be revealed. So God gives us His laws. He gives us guidance. He tells us these things you ought not do. Again, if we didn't have somebody telling us, we simply would not know. You can consider any aspect of the law. In fact, in large part, it is the purpose of the law. God did not give us His law to be some burden to us that we just can't quite live up to and feel guilty about all our life. He gave us His law because it produces the right results. Down line. In the end, You will come to see God. You will have a happy life in the end. You can take any one of them. Murder, again, apply it spiritually. Hating your brother. How many would draw the connection to bitterness later in their life because they learned to dislike somebody? They learned to hate somebody now. Yet God tells us, don't do that. It will harm you in the end. You could say the same about any other law, tithing, adultery. You don't see the immediate consequences of it. It is much later. And problems in life that happen later are rarely associated, again, especially in the spiritual sense, with the cause. Without God's standard, brethren, we simply would not know. So again, we're answering the question, why do we need a judge? Fundamentally, it is because we can't judge these aspects of our life. The only way you're able to judge these aspects and make a determination of what gets put out of your sin or out of your life as sin is because somebody tells you. Somebody greater than you and I has informed you. We simply wouldn't know the cause of pain and suffering. Because it boils down to this, your opinion would be as good as mine. Maybe I don't think it's a problem not to tithe. Maybe you do. Who would be right? Who would be wrong? We have to have somebody superior to us. We have to have somebody greater than us tell us what is right and reveal to us what is wrong. That determines how we live. So again, the first point is we need a judge because we cannot know. We simply cannot. Second cause I've come up with is we cannot discern the hearts of men. We simply cannot. Christ told the Pharisees, you are those who justify yourself before men, but God knows your hearts, for what is highly esteemed among men is abominable in the sight of God. We justify ourselves in our own hearts. Everybody does. Everybody is right. And we cannot. We simply cannot know the hearts of men. In fact, I would say it's a lifelong endeavor to know your own heart. It's what we're called to do. How many times did God talk about knowing the heart and how He discerns the heart? He reveals it is His judgment then that matters when it comes to our heart and the hearts of other men. For an example, we need to look no further than what many of us went through in the mid-90s. Prior to that, did we know? We had no clue. I shouldn't say we had no clue. We started gathering a clue. But there was a time. Everything seemed fine. But God made a judgment. God saw that what was in the heart, and He saw that it was good that this happened. And I'll be honest, I was one of the people that thought it was horrible. It was devastating. My family split up. Literally into churches and different things. I mean, we got along, but we ended up in different places. And it probably took me a good 5-7 years or so before I started looking back and realizing, in the end, it was a good thing. God knew what He was doing. God judged the church. And He executed on His judgment. So again, the second cause, second reason we need a judge is because we cannot discern the hearts of men. The third reason that I've come up with anyway, I suppose you can come up with several more, but I would say this is the biggest one in my mind. And it boils down to this. Everyone, every single one of us of the human nature are right. We simply are right in our own eyes. I think, brethren, this is one of the more insidious characteristics that humans possess. We have the amazing ability to convince ourselves how right we are regarding just about anything. In essence, this is exactly what the devil did. He convinced himself his way was better than God's. And I personally believe to this very moment, the devil believes he's right. He simply does. How many times have we heard somebody say, I know my own faults. I don't need somebody telling me, and they get the head bobbing thing going and they start getting it, you know, in your face and whatever. How many people have said, I mean, we've all heard it, whether in school or work or at home. We've all heard it. You can't tell me. Where does that come from? It comes from people that are simply right. Where do arguments come from? Two or more people that are right. Brethren, we simply cannot determine what is right and wrong. And that's not to say we shouldn't work at it. It's not to say we shouldn't lean on somebody. It's not to say we shouldn't be judging correctly and determining right from wrong. But we must know of our own natural human heart will justify itself. You will make yourself right because nobody wants to be wrong. We can be 100% convinced that we are right on something to the point where we would pass the lie detector test and still, in the eyes of God, be completely wrong. That's a little hard to come to grips with, brethren. We all like to think that's just not true. But the reality is, it is. We have a history of people that were right. And in the end, were proven to be wrong. The Proverbs word it this way. Every way of a man is right in his own eyes, but the Lord weighs the heart. A little later in Proverbs, actually a little earlier, says the way of a fool is right in his own eyes. The way of a fool is right in his own eyes. I think we can illustrate this. Again, we'll use church groups as an example. I don't know. In fact, I did a Google search this morning just out of curiosity because I got the results that, quite frankly, I would have expected. But I don't know of any church group out there that claims to be the lukewarm Church of God. Nobody's out there. In fact, you do a search for lukewarm Church of God, zero results. Funny. Nobody wants to be them. It's always somebody else. That's somebody else. Nobody's claimed to be the five foolish virgins Church of God. Everybody's those wise five. But again, we apply the versions correctly. He's saying, you're all the church. You all knew. In fact, the five foolish knew enough to have oil in their vessel or in their lamp. They didn't know enough and weren't smart enough to get it in their vessel, so they had enough to weather the storm when it came. These weren't heathens. These were people in the church. But again, it's illustrative to think. Nobody wants to be the five foolish ones. No church has formed around that idea or that concept. No church has called, I hid my talents in the ground, Church of God, or whatever you want to come up with. Nobody goes with that. Now, I will confess, I did find a Laodicean Church of God. And I didn't expect that, but I did. In fact, I found about, I think it was 50,000 hits on that. For what it's worth, it's a guy that wrote a book, and that's about all that's on the site. I don't really think there's a church behind that. But again, it illustrates it. Nobody wants to be those people. Yet God's saying some of you have that in your heart. Somebody is going to be the five foolish virgins. It is the judgment and assessments of God that matter, not what we think. And this season of all season demonstrates to us the necessity going to God and seeking His judgment. Again, the essential topic we're talking about is the righteous judgment of God in our lives. We need somebody, brethren, bigger than us to judge us. And Christ is that judge. Christ is the true standard. For brethren, we are simply not righteous when we say we are. We are only righteous to the extent Christ and God say we are. It is His assessment and His assessment alone that matters. Anything short of God's assessment is simply justification of our own righteousness. Anything short of that is us justifying ourselves. Turn with me, if you would, to John chapter 9. John chapter 9, we'll start in verse 39. This is on the heels of Christ healing the man blind. And the Pharisees getting up in arms over the fact that Christ healed somebody that was blind from birth. John chapter 9, we'll start in verse 39. And Jesus said, "For judgment I have come into this world, that those who do not see me may see, and those who see me may be made blind." This is essentially one of the reasons Christ came, to reveal the hearts of men, to make judgments, and to make an assessment. Christ entering this world will have one of two effects. It will soften your heart, make it more pliable, save those that are being reformed, or it will harden it. And again, I think even with the 12 disciples, we have an example of that. 11, they all had problems, if you recall, but 11 of them softened their heart. And in the end, they got it. They got the judgments, they got the assessment, they understood who they were, including Peter. One of them experienced all the same thing and hardened his heart. And in the end, he took his own life. So for this reason, Christ came to the world. Then some of the Pharisees who were with him heard these words and said to him, "Are we blind also?" Jesus said to them, "If you were blind, you would have no sin. But now you say, 'We see.'" Here then is the operative phrase. You say, "We see." It was in their own assessment, their own judgments. They say, "We see." And Christ is saying, "Therefore, you are guilty of your sins. You said, 'We get it. We see.' Therefore, your sin remains." Brethren, these were up, in their own assessment anyway, upright men. These were the Pharisees. These were the leaders. Yet Christ had an entirely different assessment of them. There is an example in the Bible that is, I think, very instructive along this line. It's a man that was esteemed completely stricken by God. It's a man we don't much like to read about. One who was viewed as blameless and upright by himself, yes, but also in the assessment of God. Yet even in his righteousness, he was judged, and he went through very severe trials in order to understand what he needed to know. A man often viewed as justifying himself, and rightly so. But again, God in this case confirms it. Another righteous man who needed God's judgment. Somebody, I believe, brethren, at some point in time we all can identify with. In fact, I think it represents a fear that sits in a lot of our hearts. Talking about the man Job. I think we often read this book with the view of his three friends in mind. Job did something wrong. Job's a bad guy. Job really isn't, in his own assessment anyway, isn't right. He wasn't an upright man. There were a lot of problems in his life. Do we read that book with the perspective of his three friends? A man who God says was blameless and an upright man. A man with a little more genuine, or was a little more genuine, that I think, than we often give him credit for. And a man who was truly seeking God and seeking His will and striving to do the right thing, much like we are. I think in many respects, it may not be the total story, But I think in many respects, it is a much healthier way to read the book of Job, especially Job's reply and Job's responses. He was a man who, in God's assessment, now this is God's assessment, a man who, even though he was upright, needed to learn something, needed to hear something, needed to know. He needed God to judge his life. If you would, turn to Job chapter 1. Job chapter 1 and verse 1 says, "There was a man of the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright, and one who feared God and shunned evil." So a pretty good summary. Wouldn't we all love to have that said about us? Drop down to verse 5. So it was when the days of the feast had run their course that Job would send and sanctify them. Here's talking about his sons and his daughters, but his sons mainly. And he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. So here Job is not only going every morning to offer his own offering, he's taking the extra step and offering an offering to the Lord for his children. And he gives a good reason too. For Job said, "It may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." Thus Job did regularly. So Job did this on a regular pattern, a regular behavior. And he's saying it's because they may have cursed him in their heart. Job understood that the relationship with God was in the heart. Job understood a thought can be sin. Job understood a lot about what it was like to have a relationship with God. I want to take a quick survey, just reading through this a little bit. I won't spend a lot of time commenting on many of the verses. But again, I would ask us to try to read through this more from the perspective I think we come at it with. Yes, we know we got problems in our life, but we genuinely are striving. We genuinely are trying to figure it out. And when bad things happen and that life isn't going the way we want and it's all down in the dumps, there is a reason. And I think in many respects, this is a journey of discovery for a man with an upright heart. In fact, we'll read it in just a moment. As I mentioned already, God, in his own assessment, said, Job has an upright heart. I think if we read this with the perspective of a man who is seeking answers to the judgment that he's under, it will shed a little bit of a different light on the life of Job. So let's read on. Verse 6. Now there was a day when I'm going to drop down to verse 8. Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and shuns evil?" So here's God, one, bringing it up to the devil. Devil didn't bring this up. God said, "Have you seen my servant?" And confirming that he was a blameless and an upright man, and who fears God and shuns evil. So again, this is God's assessment. This isn't Job. So in essence, God is confirming, yeah, Job's a pretty good guy. Job is trying to do the right thing. Job is an upright and an honest, and if you will, a righteous man. Drop down to chapter 2, verse 9. This is after, again, I'm not going to read all the details of the story. I'm really going to read predominantly the comments of Job, an excerpt of the comments of Job. But we know the story fairly well. He lost pretty much everything in his life. He lost his health. In this case, he still has his wife. Then his wife said to him, this is verse 9 of chapter 2. Then his wife said to him, "Do you still hold fast to your integrity? Curse God and die." But he said to her, "You speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God, and shall we not accept adversity?" In all of this, Job did not sin with his lips. So again, after all that had happened to him, during the events, during the loss of his family, his sons, his house, his herds, Job did not sin. Again, I think it's also fairly evident that his wife did not have a correct understanding and a correct view of God. Yet Job maintained his righteousness. Jump back to chapter 7. Job 7 and verse 17. Job says this, "What is man that you should exalt him, that you should set your heart on him, that you should visit him every morning and test him every moment? How long will you not look away from me and let me alone till I swallow my saliva?" Basically, he's saying, why can't you just give me a break? How long is this going to be? I'm weary. I'm under the burden. How long will it be till I get a break? Will you just suffer me to breathe? And brethren, again, I hope as we go through this, we can identify with this as we consider the trials that are sometimes in our lives. Sometimes they are sore. We are tired of them. They weary us. And in our own hearts, we would say the same thing. We would use different words, more modern words, but we would say the same thing. Can't I get a break? How many times have we prayed, I need out? Yet God knows what we can take. He is making the judgment. He is making the assessment that there is something you must learn in your life. And that, indeed, you can bear up under the weight of the trial. Reading on, verse 19 once again. How long will you not look away from me and let me alone till I swallow my saliva? Have I sinned? What have I done to you, O you watcher of men? Why have you set me as your target so that I may burden myself? Why are you doing this? Again, the journey of discovery for us. He didn't understand what was going on. In his mind, he was right. He was an upright man. But again, the righteous need God's judgment. In fact, I would dare say the righteous need it more. Because as we read back the words of Christ, we are without excuse. We simply need it. And we can relate to these verses. Drop down to Job 9. Job 9, verse 14. Job 9, verse 14 says, "How then can I answer him and choose my words to reason with him? For though I were righteous, I could not answer him. I would beg for mercy of my judge." Again, Job understood he had a judge. And he was. And if you kind of read through all of his replies, he is repeatedly wanting to go before the judge, wanting to plead his case, wanting to understand. So Job understood that he would beg of mercy for his judge. "If I called and he answered me, I would not believe that he was listening to my voice. For he crushes me with the tempest and multiplies my wounds without cause. He will not allow me to catch my breath, but fills me with bitterness." Again, that same thought, it just keeps coming. And it wears you down at times. "If it is a matter of strength, indeed he is strong. And if of justice, who will appoint my day in court? Though I were righteous, my own mouth would condemn me. Though I were blameless, it would prove me perverse." And verse 21 then is the core of Job's argument. "I am blameless, yet I do not know myself. I despise my life." Here's Job's argument. In his eyes, in his view, he was blameless, which is taking it a little too far. "Yet I do not know myself." Barnes Notes has an interesting comment on this verse. He says, "Is not this true of all claims of perfection which have ever been set up by man? Do they not demonstrate that he is ignorant of his own nature and character? So clear does this seem to me that I have no doubt that Job expressed more than 3,000 years ago what would be found true to the end of time. That if a man advanced a claim of perfection, it is conclusive proof that he does not know his own heart. A superficial view of ourselves, mingled with pride and vanity, may lead us to think we are wholly free from sin. But who can tell what he would be if placed in other circumstances? Who knows the latent depravity which would develop if he were thrown into temptation? So again, essentially, what Barnes is saying and what Job's saying is his assessment was right, but it was limited. He did not have a full view. He did not have the complete picture. He did not know what God knew. God confirmed it. Yeah, you're pretty good. What you're saying is right. But there is more. There is more. And essentially, the argument then goes like this. I am righteous. Therefore, God must do certain things for me. Brethren, God can look at you and say, yes, you are indeed righteous. What you have, you are an upright person. I agree with you. But you don't know what I know. Brethren, again, this is why we need somebody to judge us. Somebody greater than us. We need Christ's judgments in our life. Jump back to Job 23. Job 23, we'll start in verse 1. Then Job answered and said, even today my complaint is bitter. My hand is listless because of my groaning. Oh, that I knew where I might find him, that I might come to his seat. I would present my case before him and fill my mouth with arguments. I would know the words with which he would answer me. He understands what he would say to, and understand what he would say to me. Would he contend with me in his great power? No, but he would take note of me. Again, would God contend with us, with his mighty power? Would he sit down and debate our righteousness? No. But Job's saying, it's like if I could just get to him, he would hear, at least. There is there the upright could reason with him, and I would be delivered forever from my judge. Look, I go forward, but he is not there, and backwards, but I cannot perceive him. When he works on my left hand, I cannot behold him. When he turns to the right hand, I cannot see him. So Job's basically saying, it's like, no matter where I go, I try to advance, I try to back up, I try to move left, right. I can't tell what he's doing. I can't see what work he's doing in my life. And so it is so often with us. When we go through our trials, which are arguably nowhere as severe as Job's, how many times do we feel that way? How many times, to borrow a phrase from another context, how many times do the heavens feel like brass? How many times do our prayers bounce off the ceiling, at least in our heart and our mind? Brethren, there is a judgment. And there is often things in our life, the only way to see them is for God to do this kind of work in our life. Reading on. But he knows the way that I take. When he has tested me, I shall come forth like gold. Job still understands this. Job still is looking and searching for answers. When he has tested me, I shall come forth as gold. My foot has held fast to his steps. I have kept his way and not turned aside. I have not departed from the commandments of his lips. I have treasured the words of his mouth more than necessary food. So again, it just continues. Job is making the best honest assessment of his life he can. Job 31. Job 31, we'll start in verse 4, reading through 6. Does he not see my ways and count all my steps? If I have walked with falsehood, or if my foot has hastened to deceit, let me be weighed on honest scales, that God may know my integrity. Again, Job just beseeching, looking, wanting to bring his case before God, that he can know his integrity. And I know I've said it several times, but I'll say it again. The difference is, there's two beings, God and Job, making an assessment of who is right and who is wrong, or righteousness, or uprightness in this case. Job understood he was going through some very severe trials. Job understood what he could see. Job understood that he was in a lot of pain. He understood his friends were condemning him. He understood a lot. But he needed to see his life the way God saw it. So God worked with him, again, in a very severe way. A way I hope none of us have to experience. Job was making that self-assessment and did not find anything wrong with his life. God made the same assessment and did. Brethren, this is, again, the essence of why we need somebody bigger than us to make a judgment in our lives. I think there's an interesting comment by Elihu over in chapter 33. If you recall, Job had three friends that they went back and forth and back and forth on all the problems. Essentially, it boiled down to his friends were telling Job he was the one not making the right assessment. He wasn't seeing something right, and he was trying to deny the error he knew was in his life. He was self-righteous. In fact, verse 1 of chapter 32 basically says that. So these three men ceased answering Job because he was righteous in his own eyes. That's their assessment. They saw Job as righteous in his own eyes. And in a way, that's true. But I think the response of God is very instructive. And we'll get to that in a moment. But again, when we get to the end of this story, we need to see who got it and who didn't. So anyway, as the story goes on, Elihu, which is the younger, sat there quietly, listened to all this, listened to the back and forth, and gave some very instructive words. In chapter 33, we'll start in verse 8. Surely you have spoken in my hearing, and I have heard the sound of your sayings. I am pure without transgression. I am innocent, and there is no iniquity in me. Yet he finds occasion against me. He counts me as his enemy. He puts my feet in stocks. He watches all my paths. Look, in this, you are not righteous. So Elihu starts to get to the point. Elihu starts to reveal to Job the point. Look, in this, you are not righteous. For God is greater than man. For why do you contend with him? For he does not give an account of any of his words. Why are you contending with God? Brethren, all the players, all of them, his three friends, Elihu, which I assume would be numbered amongst the friends too, so four friends, Job, all of them were being judged. All of them. And if you read the story, everybody thought only one was being judged. But the fact is, they were all being judged. Job 42. Again, we know that we're very familiar with the story, so I'm skipping over the parts that are fairly well known for the sake of time. But we know the story. Job, he actually gives two answers. We usually focus on the latter one. Turn back to chapter 40 real quick, verses 3 through 5. This is in the middle of God's reply to him. This is in the middle, and I actually think it's instructive in this light. Then Job answered the Lord and said, "Behold, I am vile. What shall I answer you? I lay my hands over my mouth. Once I have spoken, but I will not answer. Yes, twice I will proceed no further. What's God's reply? Basically, Job's saying, "Say, all right, I give. I can't say anything. I don't know. I'll just stop talking. All right, all this talk about judgment and bringing my case before you, I'm going to shut up. I get it. You're great." I love God's answer. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, "Now prepare yourself like a man. I will question you and you will answer me." I find it instructive because, brethren, when we're going through this, when we're under the judgment of God and He's working some cause in our life to get us to understand something, is not the time to say, "Okay, just stop, whatever, I get it." God will, in some cases, He will get the answer He needs. Because God continues on with another set of questions for Job. Because He wanted Job to get to this point. And again, we're not going to read it all, but we know the story. Job says, "Now I see. I knew before, but now I get it. Now I see." So, great place to end up. It's a great place to end up. Again, I mentioned earlier that they were all being judged. Job 42, verse 7. "And so it was, after the Lord had spoken these words to Job, that the Lord said to Eliphaz the Temanite, 'My wrath is aroused against you and your two friends, for you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job did or has.'" So God now is making a judgment for all four of them. Job spoke what was right. You three friends did not. Very instructive when you have or you're around people that are going through severe trials of whatever variety. It is so easy to take up the view of one of Job's friends and look at them and wonder why or what they did wrong. What's wrong with them? But brethren, I think the instructive part comes when you make that call and you say that in your thoughts, God's watching, and it is going to come under judgment. All of them were judged. Elihu is not mentioned. I don't know if it was because he was younger or the fact that he spoke the truth. But Elihu was not mentioned. In fact, we'll read on here. "Now, therefore, take yourselves 7 bulls, 7 rams, and go to my servant Job and offer up for yourselves burnt offerings. And my servant Job shall pray for you, for I will accept him." Notice who God's accepting. The one who came to see. "I will accept him, lest I deal with you according to your folly, because you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has." So Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite went and did as the Lord commanded them, for the Lord had accepted Job. Again, brethren, I know it's a quick survey, a quick little run through, but it is instructive to see and to view the life of Job and his friends from a perspective not unlike us, not unlike our life when we go through trials and we go through sore events. And we all know God's in charge. We all know God allowed it, brought it about, is making his assessment, allowing certain things to go on in our life. They're not devoid. God is not unaware of what's going on in your life. But how easy it is to assume that he doesn't care or he doesn't know, that he's not paying attention. God is trying to reveal something in your life. Brethren, again, there is a judgment. I mentioned it earlier. There is a judgment that needs to happen in our lives. The greater need, I believe, is for the righteous. For those who know better. For those who say, "I see." The greater need for judgment is for us. Turn with me, if you would, to Psalm 7. David, in many respects, came to probably the same conclusion Job did, although through very different means. We know David was a man after God's own heart and expressed many of the thoughts of Christ. But again, David understood there was a judgment on the righteous. There was a judgment that needed to happen in his own life. Psalm 7, starting in verse 1. O Lord my God, in you I put my trust. Save me from all those who persecute me and deliver me, lest they tear me like a lion. Render me in pieces while there is none to deliver. O Lord my God, if I have done this, if there is iniquity in my hand, if I have repaid evil to him who was at peace with me, or have plundered my enemy without cause, let the enemy pursue me and overtake me. Yes, let him trample my life to the earth and lay my honor in the dust. Arise, O Lord, in your anger. Lift yourself up because of the rage of my enemies. Rise up for me to the judgment you have commanded. To the judgment, again, you have commanded. Here David is oppressed, surrounded by armies, and he sees it as the judgment that God has commanded. So the congregation of the people shall surround you for their sake, therefore return on high. The Lord shall judge the people. And then Job says, judge me, O Lord, according to my righteousness. So here Job is. Okay, yeah, all this trial, all this that's surrounding me, judge me, O Lord, according to your righteousness, according to your standard, according to what you say is right and wrong. Judge me. And according to the iniquity within me. Oh, let not the wickedness of the wicked come to an end, but establish a just, for the righteous God tests the hearts and minds. The righteous God tests the hearts and minds. It is a judgment that God is working out in our life. He is testing and proving our hearts and our minds. My defense is in God, who saves the upright in heart. The judgment then, in fact, if you think about it, again, Job understood the same thing David understood. They came to a conclusion probably different ways, although David's life wasn't all, butterflies and roses either. But again, Job got to the point where he could ask God to judge him in his righteousness, but judge him. Psalms 26. Psalms 26, starting in verse 1. Vindicate me, O Lord. The word vindicate in the New King James is the same word that was translated judge in the section of verse we just read earlier. So it very well could say, judge me, O Lord. In fact, the King James Version does say, judge me. For I have walked in my integrity. I have also trusted in the Lord. I shall not slip. I find this whole psalm actually quite instructive. It's a short psalm. But Job, in the previous one, was asking God, it was surrounded, having troubles, asking God for judgment, trying to understand why this is happening. Here, this whole psalm is Job putting forth his righteousness. Job putting forth what he thinks is right, where he thinks he's doing well. And honestly, I think that's something we ought to learn to do. Our work and God's work in our life ought to produce some fruits. And it is okay, to acknowledge the good things that have happened and the progress that has been made. But it is also proper and needful to come back and ask God to judge us, because we are not perfect. And that's essentially what David's doing here when he says, vindicate me in my righteousness. Here's my credentials, if you will. Here's where I think I'm doing okay. Do you agree with me? Or is there something I need to see? Is there something else I need to know about my life? I think David fully understood his assessment was not what mattered. It was God's. So again, David says, vindicate me or judge me, O Lord, for I have walked in my integrity. I have also trusted in the Lord. I shall not slip. Examine me, O Lord, and prove me. Try my mind and my heart. Job's asking, try it. Let me know if I'm not right. For your loving kindness is before my eyes, and I have walked in your truth. I have not sat with idolaters and mortals, nor will I go with the hypocrites. I have hated the assembly of evildoers, and will not sit with the wicked. I will wash my hands in innocence. I will go about your altar, O Lord. I may proclaim that the voice of thanksgiving and tell of all your wondrous works. Lord, I love thee. Love the inhabitation of your house and the place where your glory dwells. Do not gather my soul with sinners, nor my life with bloodthirsty men, in whose hands is sinister schemes, and whose right hand is full of knives. But as for me, I will walk in my integrity. Redeem me and be merciful to me. My foot stands in an even place. In the congregation, I will bless the Lord. So again, here's David. Viewed, saw some good things he was doing. Still went to God. In righteousness, he came and sought an answer from God. He sought the judgment from God on what he was doing right. It is a healthy thing for us, brethren. It is a positive thing. Quickly, Psalms 37. Psalms 37, we'll start in verse 3. Trust in the Lord and do good. Dwell in the land and feed on his faithfulness. Delight yourself also in the Lord, and he shall give you your heart's desire. Commit your way to the Lord. Trust in him, and he shall bring it to pass. He shall bring forth your righteousness as a light, and your justice as the noonday. Rest in the Lord and wait patiently for him. Do not fret because of him who prospers in his way, because of the man who brings wicked schemes to pass. Cease from anger and forsake wrath. Do not fret. It only causes harm. Brethren, we have to patiently wait on the judgments of God. We have to patiently wait. He will bring righteousness to light. Often it is in the end, though. So what are the enemies of righteous judgment? What are the things in our hearts, in our minds, in our lives that would be considered enemies of this righteous judgment, that would resist it, that would fight against it? Again, I came up with a list of 6 things. The first one I came up with is an improper understanding of God. Brethren, an accurate assessment, an accurate understanding of God is absolutely essential for you to have any heart behind saying, God, judge me. You have to see a God that loves you. You have to see a God that cares. You cannot see God as the devil does. You cannot see God as Adam and Eve came to see him. One that couldn't be trusted. One that may not, just if you have one inkling that God doesn't have your best interest at heart, you will have a very difficult time saying, judge me. Because maybe he'll do something to you that isn't your best interest. Maybe he'll be like the Roman gods and just fiddle with you and see what you do. Why she squirm? That's not how God works. We have to have a proper understanding of who God is before we could ever mean it when we say, judge me. It requires an intimate relationship with God. If you know, brethren, if you know you don't have a good, clean, authentic, honest relationship with God, you simply cannot ask this. You can say the words, but he will know in your heart. You say, well, not really. Not this time. It takes the heart of David to be able to say it and mean it. Let's turn back to Psalms 139. Here's David. O Lord, starting in verse 1. O Lord, you have searched me and know me. You know my sitting down and my rising up. You understand my thoughts afar off. You comprehend my path and my lying down, and are acquainted with all my ways. For there is not a word on my tongue. But behold, O Lord, you know it all together. You have hedged me behind and before. You have and laid your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high. I cannot attain it. Here's Job's understanding of God. He knew and fully understood that God knew every aspect, everything he did, everything he thought, every word that came across his lips, every intent of the heart. It takes that kind of relationship for us to be able to say with an authentic heart, judge me. So again, the first one I came up with as far as an enemy of righteous judgment was an improper understanding of God. The second one I came up with was a lack of spiritual maturity. Turn back to 1 Corinthians, if you would. 1 Corinthians chapter 2. First Corinthians 2, we'll start in verse 14. Again, this is a lack of spiritual maturity. Verse 14 says, but the natural man does not receive the things of the Spirit of God, for they are foolishness to him, nor can he know them, because you cannot know them, because they are spiritually discerned. The natural man cannot receive the things of the Spirit. You cannot receive the things the Spirit of God in you shows you and reveals to you of the natural man. You would not receive the judgment of God. You would continue to justify and to make yourself right for the rest of your life unless God shows you where you're not. So again, the natural man does not receive the things of the Spirit of God. Verse 15 says, but he who is spiritual judges all things, yet he himself is rightly judged by no one. So again, a spiritual maturity will allow you to go to God, to seek his judgment, and to make that assessment. God will guide you into it. He will teach you. He wants you to know. He wants you to understand. The third one I've come up with is caring what other people think. How many times do we go through life? How often do we find ourselves deciding what's right and wrong in our life because, well, our peers think it's weird, or somebody else, and we decide to act or do a certain thing because we care what other people are thinking more than we care what God thinks? It's in the same book, chapter 4, 1 Corinthians chapter 4. Verses 1 through 5 says, let a man so consider us as servants of Christ and stewards of the mystery of God. Moreover, it is required in stewards that one be found faithful. But with me, it is a very small thing that I should be judged by you or by any human court. In fact, I do not even judge myself, for I know nothing against myself, yet I am justified by this. But he who judges me is the Lord. Again, Paul fully understood and did not spend a lot of time worrying about what other people were going to say or what people would think of you if you acted a certain way. I mean, I remember being young. I got picked on for doing the right thing. And I wouldn't claim to be the best kid ever. That's true, too. But the fact is, when you do the right thing, people are going to judge you. And you're going to get some grief from it. So again, it is the enemy of a righteous judgment that should be in our life. The fourth one, being partly right. I think if we go back to some of the thoughts we had early on in the message about how we will justify ourselves, it's just a human trait, it's a human character trait. Everybody does it. Everybody wants to be right. Nobody wants to be thought to be wrong. Brethren, being partly right allows us the leverage we need to justify our stance. How many times have we been in disagreement or arguments with somebody and this surfaces? Because here's the totality of the discussion. I was right here, therefore, but look, how many times do we say that? The biblical example, Christ tells us to agree with our adversary while we are in the way. Agree with them quickly. Now, yes, it's talking about human courts, but who's our greatest adversary? The devil. What did the devil do in the Bible? In Job, he brought accusations to God. He said, yeah, that's just because you're protecting him. Yeah, if you did this. And he does it. We know he's our accuser. Brethren, I think the spiritual principle of that concept is when the devil is minutely right, agree with it. He will bring accusations against you. And a lot of times, he's going up to God saying, you know what, that Frankie dude, look at the thoughts he just had. If you know that, again, being partially right doesn't make you righteous. Being partially right, we will be able to justify ourselves. We will feel as Job did, right, I'm pretty good. I don't get it. What's wrong? I'm right. God sees it all. So again, being partly right can be an enemy of righteous judgment. The fifth one, oddly enough, I actually had a hard time writing this one down, but it's true. Oddly enough, spiritual growth can become an enemy of righteous judgment. We've heard sermons, or many times, many of us will have heard sermons in the past about spiritual plateaus. It's essentially the same thing. It's essentially spiritual growth. We get to a certain point, we exhale because I've arrived. And we sit on a plateau and we don't realize there's 50,000 more feet to climb. Well, we're comfortable. It's flat. We sit down and we hold. So if you think about it, spiritual growth itself can be an enemy of righteous judgment. Christ said, or Paul said it, he says, there is none righteous, no, not one. Brethren, there is not a one of us that has reached the pinnacle. There is not a one of us that has done walking, our Christian walk. There's not a one of us that is done growing spiritually. Don't let the good thing that is in you be a barrier for making more progress. And the final one I have is comparing yourself to one another instead of Christ. And this goes back to something we mentioned earlier. There is only one standard, one and one alone, that we have to look to. It is Christ. Paul said, we press toward the mark of the prize of the high calling in God in Christ Jesus. He is our mark. He is the one. Do not fall into the trap of looking around, finding somebody you can feel comfortable with because you think in your own mind you're a little better than them. You do not know their heart. You do not know their relationship with God. You don't know what they're struggling with. You don't know their background. Don't compare ourselves to others. You will always find somebody you can be better than. When I say that, I guess if you drew a big map of the whole world and lined everybody up, somebody would have to be at the bottom. But the fact is, you can find somebody. Everybody can feel pretty good because you can find somebody else that you go, look at them. And you go on your merry way. We simply must compare ourselves only to Christ. So how can we discern our own heart? We are told in Hebrews chapter 4, and I know y'all are probably getting hungry. We're almost done. Hebrews chapter 4, verses 12 and 13. For the word of God is living and powerful and sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing even to the division of the soul and spirit, and of joints and marrow, and is a discerner of the thoughts and the intents of the heart. And there is no creature hidden from his sight, but all things are naked and open to the eyes of him to whom we must give account. How do we discern our own hearts, brethren? God's given us this. He's given us prayer. He's given us fasting. He's given us each other. He's given us, iron sharpening iron. Brethren, we discern our hearts by getting to know the judge, by going to the judge, by seeking his counsel, by asking him to judge you, by asking him to reveal the heart, to discern your own heart. This requires a complete surrender to the will of God. It's what Christ said in John 5:30. You can read it some other time, but that's what Christ said. He goes, I do this. I go and I surrender this all. Christ, while he was on this earth, surrendered himself to the righteous judge. Again, he is the one we follow. We must also, likewise, surrender all to the righteous judge. Brethren, asking God to judge you, it takes this complete surrender. It takes an unfeigned willingness to hear what he has to say. We can't fake it. We can't say the words and then want to ignore what he's trying to do in your life. It takes an unfeigned willingness to hear it. It is also an invitation for God to dwell in every part of your life. Not one area of your life should be untouched by God. It exposes you to the gaze of his eye, the piercing gaze, to the depths of who you are. Brethren, we need to develop this relationship with our God. We need to develop the one where we can sincerely and honestly and in the most authentic way possible go to him and ask him to judge you. And as I've tried to make the case throughout the message, it is more important for us. For we see, we have had our eyes opened. The judgments of Christ in our life must happen. And when the judgment comes, because it will, he is just and faithful to perform. He will perform it if you seek it. When that judgment comes, brethren, be glad. Be glad. Because it means you have a God that cares.